Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored by the 2006 Palm Beach Improv Festival. Improv U proudly presents the 2006 Palm Beach Improv Festival, September 8th through the 11th, at Actors Rep Theater in West Palm Beach. The Palm Beach Improv Festival offers performances and workshops, as well as the chance to build lasting friendships. Submissions to perform are due by July 5th. Improv U is a nonprofit dedicated to bringing the art of improvisation to South Florida. Register today at palmbeachimprovfestival.com. And we're also sponsored by the 8th Annual Improv Festival, Oklahoma, which will be held from September 29th to October 2nd in Oklahoma City. This single-venue festival will feature performances and workshops with special guests John Barinholtz and Rob Belushi. I taught and performed at Improv Festival Oklahoma a couple years ago, and I can tell you they have a great improv community in Oklahoma City. Submission deadline is July 31st. For more information, visit improvoklahoma.com. And this episode is also sponsored by Huge Summer Intensive. You're invited to the Huge Summer Intensive in Minneapolis. This year's theme is your voice, finding it, using it, playing with it. Your choice of August 12th through the 14th or August 26th through the 28th. Study with the international improviser Jill Bernard and renowned voice coach Keely Walter. The first weekend features Brave New Workshop alum Jim Detmeyer. The second weekend features Chicago legend Michael Gelman. Learn more at HugeTheater.com. We got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Our guest today is Jason Weiner. He's a director, producer, and writer, and he's directed and produced such hit sitcoms like Modern Family, Life in Pieces, and The Crazy One. This Emmy-winning producer is a graduate of Northwestern University and studied at the IO Chicago, where I first met him. He was on a team called The Tribe, which at that time was doing a thing called the Improvised Movie. We talked to Jason about so many things in this interview, how he first started improvise with his mother at a very young age, what he was good at in improv and what he was not so good at in improv, and how he gets the best out of his actors when he's directing sitcoms. Before we get to the episode with Jason, I just want to say I'm really frustrated. When I record the intro, the part you just heard, and then the part you're hearing now, I do it on GarageBand on my Apple computer. Well, it's really wonky, and it usually takes me, if I'm not in my perfectionist mode, it usually takes me about 40 minutes. Well, it's taken me a lot longer. Plus, it's a really nice day out here in Chicago, and I want to go to the beach when Lauren gets home. She's at the doctor, and we're 4 days away from the due date. We still don't have a baby yet, and they tell me it could come any time now. So, but that aside, I just want to finish this recording, so because Lauren thinks that I spend too much time recording the intros and outros, which she's absolutely right, and when she gets home, I want to go to the beach. I just thought I heard her come in. So anyways, so for those of you who don't like this part of the monologue, you've emailed me and said I've shared too much information, it's too personal, you're not going to get a story. And for those who do like it, hopefully next week I'll have a story for you. But we all win because we got a great episode. Here it is, the Jason Weiner episode. I just want a quick note before we start. It was a phone interview, so there's a little clicking at the beginning, so I apologize for that, but it does improve as the episode goes on. So here it is, the Jason Weiner episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
You know, my grandmother was a visual artist. She was a painter and a sculptor, and she was a big influence on me. And my mom used to play like little games with me, like, you know, we would get in an elevator together and she would look at me and make something up, like, that I was expected to go along with. It's frankly an improv game. You know what I mean? Like she would make an offer in the elevator and I would have to yes and it, otherwise it was more embarrassing. And she liked to sort of play jokes and tricks on strangers that way.
And were you okay? Did you enjoy it? Or I would imagine you could be embarrassed by it, you know, if you were younger, right?
Yeah. I was a little embarrassed, but also I would go along with it. And I think in the grander scheme of things, I kind of appreciated the badassness of it.
And in 1990, you come to Northwestern University, where you were a double major in theater and photography.
Yeah.
And you get involved with the Meow Show, which has a great reputation. They do Second City style sketch review, and it had amazing members, Julius Louis-Dreyfus, Seth Meyers, Anna Gastar. What was one of your favorite memories of being part of that group?
I mean, you know, being a member of the Meow Show at Northwestern is like a little bit like being a rock star. I mean, people think of like improv stuff as kind of nerdy, and it is sort of nerdy. But improv stuff and comedy in that context on a college campus makes you cool. And so, you know, everybody wanted to be in the Meow Show. I didn't get into my senior year, and I kind of joined a cast that had already been put together the previous year. So, but it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. You do these shows in Shanley Pavilion, which is like this, I don't even know if it exists on the Northwestern campus anymore, but that place, it was like this sweaty shack, just be filled with semi-drunk students, and it had this electricity. There was nothing like it. You do a bigger show later in one of the big theaters on campus, but those Shanley Pavilion previews are the ones that everybody remembers.
And you were two years ahead of Seth Meyers at Northwestern. What do you remember about him?
Yeah, I mean, I know Seth well. We're friends now to this day, but we didn't know each other well in school. We have that Meow Show connection. And I know his brother well, just socially out here in Los Angeles. So I think everybody that comes from that Meow Show background shares, it's a pretty tight-knit fraternity. I'm friends with, I think, other generations of Meow people that I didn't know at school.
So in 1994, you then graduate, and you make a whole bunch of friends from the Meow Show, and you guys go to I.O., and you form a team at the time called The Tribe. And it's usually Sharna picks people for teams. How were you guys able to pick off, to pull off sticking together as a group?
Well, we had a guy who was in the Meow Show in my cast that we were close with, Ed Herbstman, who you may know.
Yes, yes.
And Ed had been studying with Sharna for years. He was kind of like, you know, he was improv obsessed from the time he was probably 8 years old. And so Sharna knew him. And I think that gave us, I think he sort of made the introduction and said, this is my group and we've been performing together, and kind of convinced her to give us a slot somehow. I don't remember exactly the details, but I do know that people didn't like us for that reason. you know what I mean? Because it was like this weird favoritism. Like, why does this group get to come in as a group and just start being a team here? I don't know why we were allowed to do it, but we did have a great chemistry together. And I like to think that we put on a pretty good show together. So maybe she liked that, you know?
The other thing, and I've always been envious of Northwestern. I secretly wanted to go there. I always felt that Northwestern, people that came out of Northwestern, there was a drive about them. There was a professionalism about that. Is that just in my head?
No, I think, look, it's a hard school to get into, so it starts with that. And I think the school does a good job of cultivating that in the way that it's structured. I mean, circling back to something for me, like, I don't know if I'm giving the school credit for this, but you couldn't minor in anything there. That wasn't something you were allowed to do, but you could double major. So I kind of figured out a way to study all the things I wanted to study. I was a performance studies major, which for me was awesome because it combined the best of theater and literature, because I was always writing and reading, and I kind of went into school as an English major, so it combined some of the best of that with also acting classes and a little bit of directing classes, and then some heady stuff as well that was taught by, you know, I always say that it's like the snobby version of a theater major, and it is to a certain extent. But to combine my interest in the visual arts, I double majored in art so that I could take all the all the studio classes I wanted, but I figured out early on that I only needed one of those majors to graduate. So I literally just declared the second major so I could get in those classes that weren't open to non-majors. And that's where the photography emphasis came from, just because I wanted to do that. And I love spending hours and hours in the dark room, and I love photography, but I didn't want to bother with all the art history stuff. So I didn't bother taking it. I realized I only needed my performance studies major to graduate. Now, is that something that Northwestern helped me figure out? Is that something Northwestern cultivated by their antiquated rules? I don't know.
But I remember this is a long years ago when you were in Chicago. And I remember you being part of Roadworks, which was a theater group here in Chicago. And
that's
you
true.
Got, I mean, like when, and certainly they, you guys followed another Northwestern group that was Looking Glass, David Schwimmer and his whole group. You guys, you know, you would reach out to your friends and your family to raise money and have fundraisers and, you know, put your shows up really professionally. And there was a businessness. There was, that's not a word, but there was, would you agree to that?
Yeah, you know, and I think that ambitious kids are kind of drawn together and they're drawn to each other. If I remember correctly, I wasn't actually a member of Roadworks. It was kids that were like a year ahead of me, but I was drawn to them because they were ambitious and so was I. So I got involved with them. It's funny that you use that term businessness, because if I remember correctly, the driving force behind Roadworks was a woman named Debbie Bisno, who they used to nickname the business. I think she's now like the artistic director, a big artistic director in New York here.
You know, I'm glad you are very honest about your ambition. It's something that I wish I could tap into now, and I wish I had it younger. Where did that ambition come from?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I was born with it to a certain extent. I just, from a very young age, knew I wanted a career in the arts, whether it was acting, whether it was theater. You know, I didn't put all the pieces together that it would be directing and producing until much later on, but I was just, I loved those things and I just knew that's where I was headed. And I was, the word is ambitious and I don't know why.
But you never let anything get in your way. Is that true?
I mean, I guess I like to think that I was motivated by like making things, you know what
right.
I mean? And people ask me like for advice, like if you're coming to Los Angeles and you want to, and that, I mean, that's the answer. Like, so long as you're driven by making the thing, whatever it is, then you don't get caught up in all the bullshit that surrounds it, that this business often is about. I mean, I like to think that, yes, while I have ambition, there's an integrity that goes in along with that, because the ambition is to make the thing. It's not to be recognized for making the thing.
At I.O., You guys start you start doing a form called the movie, the improvised movie.
Yeah.
And I believe the family had done it first and they handed it down to you. And can you tell us because you guys were probably, I would imagine, the first, or you weren't the first, but at least the second or third people doing the improvised movie.
Yeah. Yeah. We learned it directly from Dell. I think Dell had worked on it with the family. And I'm not sure it's fair to say the family handed it down to us, because I'm not sure we ever did it with their permission. Maybe we should have. But I think because Dell felt that he innovated it, he felt free to teach it as a form. And we learned it as a form from Dell and just started doing it. I feel like we were all drawn to it because we were kids that were obsessed with movies. And I feel like organically our style of doing it developed in a kind of a different direction than the family. I saw the family do it a bunch of times and they were incredible, but they definitely had their style and we had kind of a different style. I'm not sure how to articulate it. I will say that I even look back on those days and I think objectively I was not as good of an improviser as the other people on my team. I honestly think that in some ways, at least with the scene work, I was a weak link. But I do think I was adding something. I would think holistically when we were doing the movie. I would think about the story. And I was the one most frequently that edited. I was the editor on stage. I would edit and take us to the next thing. I felt like I was part of the big picture thinking. And in a weird way, I've reflected on this just because it relates to my career and the way that my career developed as a director after that.
And by 1997, you guys changed the name of the group to Bitter Noah. And you're doing the improvised movie. And then the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, which, you know, is like, was huge, which a huge festival could break a lot of people out, asked you to come and perform there. What was it like? I mean, here are all these big people, you know, who go to this festival. What was that like? Here you guys, you're what, 3 years out of Northwestern, and now you're going to the Aspen Comedy Festival.
Yeah, it was a huge break for us. It was crazy. You know, what was cool is that we had each other. You know, moving to Los Angeles is hard at first to get a foothold, to get to know anybody. But like, here was this group of people, the tight-knit, similar way of thinking about creativity, about improv, you know, about comedy in general. And because we had this thing that we could do together, the improvised movie, people were drawn to us. You know, they're saying, you know, you have something you're quote unquote selling. And I suppose that's what we were selling. But again, that we didn't think of it that way. It was the thing. It was the thing we loved to do, the thing we loved to create. So we would be in movies. And yes, getting invited to Aspen was huge. And from there, we got signed by CAA. I mean, like the biggest agency going, and being like another huge break. But after a year of a lot of big promises from CAA and a couple of interesting meetings, but mainly unreturned phone calls, we sort of started to unravel because we had been signed with big hopes. We fitted to each other to essentially only be the group, not pursue individual acting or writing opportunities. We were all in for creating. Essentially what we wanted to do was create some sort of sketch show, like Mr. Show at the time was the big thing, and we wanted to do something similar for MTV or a fledgling cable network, and CAA was helping us to that goal, but we were falling somewhat short, and we weren't sure what was next.
What was that like? Because you guys, you know, certainly it's been time at Northwestern and Chicago, and a lot of stuff happened really fast. How do you walk away?
You mean from the group?
Yeah, from the group. How do you just, you know, is it, you know, it just dissolves itself? Do you have a meeting?
It was really painful. It was really painful. We were all best friends. We all spent every week together. Amongst the you know, how many, there were six of us at the time. We, you know, there were different groups of us. One pair, you know, was a couple, you know, in there. And everybody had different opinions about what should be next. You know, I was of the mind that we had given this thing of this sort of all-in philosophy a try. I really wanted to remain a group, but open up our horizons so that we could each pursue individual interests. And yeah, we did have a meeting that was filled with a lot of emotions, and that where people expressed their different desires of next, and I think it was a turning for all of us.
And then after that, you continue to pursue acting. You do very well with commercials, and then you, in 2005, you direct a sitcom pilot called Big Handsome Guy and His Little Friend.
Yes. The part we're skipping is that as a group, after we broke up, after that big painful conversation, a project we had been trying to sell suddenly sold through a producer we had been working with, and we created this thing called The Blame Game, which was based on an improv form we used to do at Improv Olympic called Sue Your Ex, which was an improvised courtroom trial. And suddenly, we had this show on MTV together as a group after we had broken up. So the sort of the goal kind of weirdly came together. I was on that show as the lawyer representing the dudes. And, you know, the show, quite honestly, while it was exploitative in some ways, it was also a little bit ahead of the reality curve. It's like this weird hybrid sketch show game show, reality show. It was on every day between Tom Green and Total Request Live, and it got a good number for MTV, but it was also very sexual and salacious, and I think they were eager to not promote it because they were doing something sneaky by putting it on in the late afternoon for kids to watch. They didn't need any other, they plenty of eyeballs, they didn't need any other trouble about it, essentially. So it didn't really lead to anything for us as a group or for me as a writer, even though we were behind the scenes creating the thing. What it did lead to was acting opportunities because I was on the show. So, you know, I did guest stars on things and a few small movie roles, and I was able to make my living as a commercial actor. And making your living as an actor is like a dream. That's the dream for a lot of people. But for me, I found myself very dissatisfied creatively with it.
Well, did you remember that time where you know, a lot of people think, you know, getting on a TV show is the end all be all. But if that's not what you want to be, it can be kind of painful. Was there a moment where you were on a set where you were doing something and you're like, you know what, I don't really want to do this. I'd rather direct.
Well, doing the Blame Game was very fulfilling because we created that show and we were producers on that show and writing that show. Now, money-wise, I was literally making the same amount I had been making as a waiter. MTV does not pay well. But that said, it was really fun and creative and fulfilling because I was wearing a number of hats and I enjoyed that. But after that, when it flattened out into a more conventional acting career, going to auditions, sitting in waiting rooms, trying to memorize sides, and then just being a cog in the wheel. I remember, I think, doing an Avis commercial where I was like, on set and, you know, doing my job and saying my one line, you know, 80 different ways and thinking like, this is not creative. I'm also sitting there thinking, why are they shooting it in this order? It doesn't make any sense. They should be shooting in this other order. And like, why do they even have the camera over there? It would be funnier if we did X, Y, and Z. And I kept thinking that way as I was doing acting roles here and there. And I started to turn into that asshole actor that would try and manipulate the process by saying, I don't think my character would do that. You know what I mean?
Like, oh my God. And what kind of reaction did you get from directors when you did?
Well, you know, I was never a jerk about it. I look back on it and think I was a jerk, but I was just growing bolder because my desire to direct and my desire to be in charge of the process, the creative process, was growing. And so I was trying to assert myself within my limited window as an actor. And it wasn't, it was increasingly appropriate. And at a certain point, I just had to say to myself, I got to put my money where my mouth is. I'm starting to feel this way. I got to get brave enough to actually direct something.
What do you do today? And we don't need names or anything like that. When an actor comes to you and does the same thing that you did as an actor,
I try and overwhelm them with positivity. You know what I mean? I have all kinds of tricks, but one of them is the manipulative compliment. You know what I mean? Where I compliment something that an actor didn't do on a take in order to suggest that they do that the next take.
And you're copying that. That's totally manipulative.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. My job is to manipulate people.
I love your honesty. I love it. So let's get back. So then you're in this transition. You're basically a director trapped in an actor's body.
I think so. I think it's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
And then you direct this pilot, this sitcom pilot called Big Handsome Guy and His Little Friend.
Well, it isn't a pilot yet.
Okay.
It's a short film. And you know, when I said that I felt that I needed to put my money where my mouth was, that was almost literal. I had made a certain amount of money, especially as a commercial actor. And I kind of knew that once I started trying to make a film, I'm a perfectionist, and I knew that money was going to go fast. So I better make it the right idea, an idea that has a chance to grow into something bigger. If I'm making a short film, it's not just going to be for the hell of it. It's going to be to sell as something bigger. And so I had searched for the right concept, And then I hadn't found it. I was writing different scripts saying, is this the one basically to bet on black, to put all my money down and say, okay, I'm going to make this. And he threw out a couple different scripts, a couple different concepts before Big Handsome Guy came along. Big Handsome Guy came out of the relationship between me and my friend Hayes Arthur. Hayes is 6'5" and handsome and charming, and everything in life seems easy for him. He was the quarterback for his college football team. He grew up rich in Chicago, and he just literally doesn't understand neuroses. He's a guy that doesn't understand why you'd worry about stuff. And to me, that's hilarious, because like I feel like my whole sort of comedic perspective on the world involves, you know, worry. You know what I mean? Like I worry about things, fret over things, you know. We had a really funny, we are genuinely friends, and we have a connection that goes back to Chicago, and we felt that we would laugh at each other as we tried to explain each other at the worldview. And at a certain point, I felt like there was a comedic dynamic, a game in the scene, if you will, in our relationship. And at one point, we were at a party together, and we hugged. We were hugging goodbye, and he's 6'5", I'm 5'4". So when we hugged, it formed like kind of a weird parallelogram. And people looked at us. We felt the looks askance as we hugged. And that moment stuck with me the following day, and the title then followed, popped into my head, The Adventures of Big Handsome Guy and His Little Friend. And I said to Hayes, like, I think this is a short. I think we should start working on this. And we worked on the script for a year, 1 year, writing 15 pages.
1 year to write 15 pages.
We wanted it to be the right 15 pages. We knew we were going to fall on this. At this time, this is 2005, digital technology was emerging, but it still looked great. You couldn't make something look awesome. It would still look like a video. I had made a couple little short things in Chicago, but nothing extensive. But behind the monitors, and I'm thinking, all the photography I did, all the improv, all, you know, that class in performance studies called presentational aesthetics, which is kind of a directing class, even though it was this heady thing. All of that stuck together, and I'm like, this is what I'm meant to be doing. This literally combined all the things I've been interested in my whole life, and I'm 29 at this point and doing it for the first time, but it feels like I've been doing it my whole life.
And so this leads to a pilot deal,
yes,
is that correct?
So this film got me signed as a writer-director at ICM. And then they put us together with some showrunners, and the showrunners helped shape the vision as a TV show. And we sold it to 20th Century Fox TV, which weirdly is where I've been literally my entire career since. I'm talking from my office right now on the 20th Century Fox lot.
And I remember this, and you help me out, or if you don't want to talk about it, we can move on. But there was kind of a controversy. Didn't it not get picked up as a pilot, and then it got released? Somebody released it,
was
that the story?
Well, it wasn't exactly a controversy. We got real. So the short film was long, and it got everybody really excited. This was before the notion of short films as a basis of TV development. Now that's par for the course. At the time, it was very unique, very special. So people were excited. They had this thing to point to that said, this is the tone that we're going for. This is the relationship we're expanding on. That was all a new idea, and it helped us sail through the development process. Now, what was incredible about that, and the best thing that ever happened in my career, was that I didn't direct the pilot. When the Belgian pilot came out, it was finished. Everybody, at the end of the day, the network, basically did much as the short film it was based on. And for better or for worse, they thought to themselves, well, we didn't let Jace direct it. And pointed to that as the missing, and they regretted not letting him direct it. And they said, we got to give him money to do something else. I want this to go great. Yes, let's bring in somebody awesome to direct the pilot. And what and this took fine, but it was the process of a TV show can pull and push at something from someone else, that it can take away some of what's special about it. And I have really specific things I get into about what the process and philosophies I've developed over the year that started in this scenario. But the upshot of it was that when it completed, the network did like their 21-minute, $3 million version, as much as our 15-minute, $15,000 version. And they applied the missing ingredient as me directing.
Why didn't you want to direct that?
Well, I felt like I had enough on my plate. You know, I was writing this, but also acting it up. I said, hey, at that point, even though in some ways Darkness had been my biggest break as an actor to date, my fire for it had diminished. That wasn't really my ambition. My ambition for the acting part had faded, and the directing had taken over. So, but that said, still being in the pilot was a big undertaking, and I felt like at the time that was enough.
And then, how does that lead to Modern Family?
We could have let Jaden direct that pilot. Money direct something else, his own thing. And so I went off, and with a little bit of money from them, I wrote a script called Giants of Radio. I was obsessed with talk radio then, and I love it now still. And so I wrote sort of, you might call it 30 Rock at a radio station. It was behind the scenes at a big kind of conglomerate that had a bunch of different radio hosts working at it. And nobody was paying attention to this because they were giving me a small amount of money to make it, not just to write it. They were like, go do it. It was such a small amount of money to them that I literally had free creative reign. The only problem is, like, I'm limited, I think, in my skill as a writer. I'm good with story, a skill that, by the way, I would attribute directly to, like, those days studying with Dell. Understanding structure and understanding theme and how just the way he taught that was sunk in a way that I feel like I draw upon to this day. But that said, I'm good with story, but I'm a bad joke writer. I can't really formulate the dialogue into jokes. So what I wrote at the time for Giants of Radio was a kind of a Curb Your Enthusiasm style detailed story outline. And then I cast talented improvisers to execute it so that the jokes would come organically in the moment based on the story and the games that I was laying out. So Giants of Radio became like a thing. When it was done, everybody was like, whoa, where did this come from? I turned in a completely finished 21-minute pilot when they were only expecting a 5 to 10 minute presentation.
Is that something that's important for people to hear, that to go beyond their expectations? If somebody wants something, it seems like you did that with a big handsome guy when you originally did the film. Now you're doing it with this. You're like, I'm going to go beyond what they're expecting.
Yeah. Maybe. Again, you know what's funny? I didn't do it consciously. It wasn't because I was motivated by the thing that I really am going to get their attention. I was motivated because I had a whole story in my head, and I didn't want to just shoot part of it. It goes back to the same thing, Jimmy. It's the thing. I wanted to make this thing really badly, so badly that I wouldn't be told I could only make part of it.
And you wanted to make it the best you could, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Whatever that meant to you, if it meant money out of your pocket or it meant longer hours or whatever, it was, you wanted to, maybe it's part of your perfectionism.
Yeah, maybe. And it also meant that, you know, there were a couple people at the studio that told me explicitly, because I had asked. So I said, listen, I wrote the whole script. I want to make the whole thing. And they're like, we're only asking for a presentation. And there was one person in particular where I was like, does that mean I can't make the whole thing if I could do it for the same money? And they told me explicitly not to make the whole thing. And I did it anyway.
And so you make that. And then how does Modern Family come?
Well, I made that. And it the finished thing got sent around town. And it created a bidding war amongst multiple networks. And one network, CBS, paid the studio, 20th Century Fox TV, a large amount of money to consider it this finished thing as a finished pilot for their fall schedule. So while it didn't end up getting on the air, it literally, they, I think, paid something in the neighborhood of $2 million.
Now, do you get any of that? Is that a benefit?
No, none of it. No, none of it.
Is that hard for you?
No, I don't care. Not at all. I want the thing. I want to make the thing. I want to make more of the thing. So no, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it because of what it said to that person who told me not to make the whole thing. That's the part I'm proud of. That person said, don't make the whole thing. And, you know, the overall budget, I can tell you, of that project, the entire production budget for the finished 21-minute pilot was $150,000. And it sold to a network for $2 million. I'm proud of that.
All right. So you've sold it to a, and then how does the pilot of Modern Family come from that?
So I that didn't get on the air, Giants of Radio, but it became like this story, this thing people were talking about. Like, how did that happen? Where did that come from? How was this thing able to be made for this small amount of money? And I'll be honest with you, these days, it almost killed me. How it was made for that little money is like, I almost literally killed myself.
You mean for health reasons? I mean, you were...
Yeah. The amount of hours and how hard I had to work and how much I had to beg people to do favors and to get it done for that price, the rules I had to break and the things. And it was only possible because nobody was looking. I couldn't do it today. No way. Not just because I'm older and I don't have the energy level, but because nobody would cut me that kind of break now. You know what I mean?
Right. Do those people come back, or you've reached back out to them and said, look, you know, I'm in a position, I can, you know, hire you, or, hey, would you give me a job?
Yeah, well, I still work with David Jones, who's my DP, shot Giants of Radio, is still my DP. He shot the pilot of Life in Pieces for me.
Okay, so Modern Family.
Yeah, Modern Family. So we're getting there.
Yeah.
So basically, that Giants of Radio led to a series of deals and opportunities. I was able to write. I got hired to direct a real big budget pilot off of that, which was Liz Merriweather's first pilot for broadcast. She wrote and created New Girl. Mm-hmm. So she this was before that for both of us, before Modern Family for me, before New Girl for her. We did this thing called Sluts, which was a pilot for Fox. That was like my first big budget thing and my first experience like working inside that system. And in spite of it being something that was like, it was an underdog from the get-go. It wasn't something anybody really expected to go. I think it was an experiment. It got really close to actually getting on the air. And then that led to something else for ABC that I wrote and directed called This Might Hurt, which was another sort of Curb Your Enthusiasm, semi-improvised style pilot that I did with my improv friends and other talented people that I drew in, and that got really close to going. And that was the thing that Steve Levitan and Chris Lloyd saw. The studio gave them and said, you know, this thing may or may not go to series. ABC is still considering it, but they really like the director based on this. Maybe you would consider him for your pilot, which at that time was called My American Family. And so that's how I found myself meeting with Levitan and Lloyd and talking about directing what became Modern Family.
When you went in to meet those guys, because by then, they have certainly a great reputation, both of them. How did you feel when you went into that meeting with them?
Well, this is part of the revisionist history. I mean, okay. Chris, they are both television legends, 100%, and incredibly talented guys who I've learned so much from. If we have time, I'll tell you some of that. But at the time, they were coming off of a failed multi-camera sitcom for Fox. And everybody likes to talk about this notion that the script for Modern Family was undeniable. But they were at a low point for them in their careers. And not only that, family comedy was considered very uncool. Nobody wanted that pilot script. Nobody was interested in it. The only place where it ended up, ABC, was really the only bidder. And so even at ABC, as a script, it was something they were curious about. Could we do a single camera comedy about a family? Is that a way to possibly reinvigorate our family comedy thing, which is sort of an ABC brand? And nobody considered it cool, including me. I felt it was a second choice for me. My show, This Might Hurt, which I had written for ABC and directed for ABC, was still actively in consideration at that time. And in fact, we were in a negotiation, the network and studio, about picking it up for 13 episodes to air experimentally during the summer. And I was being told that was going to happen. So when I went in, I was like thinking of it as a kind of a, you know, kind of a, I've heard great things about these guys. In case my thing doesn't go, I should meet with them, but hopefully I won't have to do this stupid family comedy. That was how I saw the meeting, which is why the meeting went great. Because whenever you feel like you're saying, guys, it's great to meet you, but I have this other thing I'm working on, that's a great way to make somebody want you, right?
So the secret is always have something that you're working on that you're more interested than the thing they're going to offer you.
Well, it goes back to the, you know, if your obsession is the thing you care about, that you can't get nervous because my obsession was the thing. This might hurt was the thing I cared about. I made it. It came from me. I wanted that to go. So that's where my focus was.
You know, this point is a good one. It's one that I forget all the time. But really, and I want your opinion on this. You create your own stuff and you're going to get opportunities that you never would have imagined.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's I think the point I keep making. If your passion is creating your own stuff and you're not worried about what might come from it, you can never go wrong. People are drawn to you.
Because if you think about it, up until Modern Family, I mean, you know, you had pilots, but nothing had made it on air.
That's
and,
right.
And really, when Modern Family is offered to you, you're like, well, I'm not really that interested in this. And that's the thing that really put you on the map.
Yeah, yeah. And so then what ended up happening was at the very last minute, This Might Hurt got passed on. And it got passed on because of the economic meltdown. What was happening was the crash in 2008 had taken place, and Disney had to lay off 500 employees. So they actually were talking, but what happened overnight, they were on the verge of closing the deal to pick it up for 13 episodes. In fact, the studio called me and said, you can celebrate tonight. This is happening. And I said, but I haven't heard from the network yet. I'm going to wait on that celebration. I didn't quite believe it. And sure enough, the next day, they said, we're really sorry. We can't justify picking up this experimental summer comedy when we have to lay off 500 people, and that's going to be in the news today. We don't want to announce that. We're not going to do it. And I was left in a position where I basically had to call up Steve Levitan and say, hey, do you still want me for that thing? I'll do it now. And he had been holding the job open for me, thank God. And I went in and I was faking it at first. I was faking that I was excited about it. It was a consolation prize.
Let's back up for just a second, because I really want to understand your process. So here's a show you had your heart on, you know, to get it made, your heart set on it. And then all of a sudden, that is removed from you. That's taken
yes.
away from you.
Yes.
How do you deal with that disappointment? How do you deal with that rejection? How do you get over it?
Yeah, that was hard. That was my baby. And even Steve and Chris were like, I mean, that's why they wanted me to direct their pilot, because they loved it. They saw it and they were like, we really see something. This is funny. It's better than a lot of stuff ABC has on the air. They should do this. And so in a weird way, they were telling me they expected it to get picked up because they thought it was good. And that meant a lot coming from those guys. And so, yeah, it was super disappointing. It was something I had started writing even before the writer's strike, and it had survived the writer's strike and kind of came back to life afterward. It really seemed like it was going to happen. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I got over it because you're sensing a theme. You know, I throw myself back into the next thing, whatever that is creatively.
You don't get depressed. You don't, you know, go and take a long nap for 5 hours and sulk around the, you know, the house. You don't do any of that.
No, I do get depressed, but I've never been a sulker.
Okay.
I throw myself into the next thing. Mm-hmm. And for a minute, it takes me a minute to feel excited about the next thing, but I keep working until I feel better.
And you know, my problem is, if I would, when I get rejected, it's like I make it personal and I say, you know, like it's about my talent. I'm no good. To me, it sounds like you don't have those messages in your head.
No, I don't think I do. I credit my parents for that, honestly.
In what way?
I think they're, I just have a great relationship with my parents. They've always been really supportive and really believed in me. And I think when you have that in your home and it the right kind of, you know, positive messages and, you know, tapes get the right kind of tapes get recorded in your head.
So you're on the set now on Modern Family and you have to fake it as a director that you're excited about that. When did the fakeness of that become reality?
It became reality well before I was on set. I mean, there's a pretty long process to putting it together. And very quickly, I realized I was in something with giants of this industry that I could learn something from. And I got very excited about that.
What was the moment where you realized it was, oh my God, this is great?
You know, through the casting process, through Steve's confidence in the material, through Chris's thoroughness and his willingness to look at it so many different ways, through the way that they handled themselves with the studio and network, through their belief in the material, through Steve's insistence that, you know, Kind of Funny will be the death of us. He was not satisfied. And he also is also surprisingly willing. He wouldn't get frustrated by the network or the studio saying that's not good enough or we don't want that. He never tried to assert his point of view or say, I know better, or my Emmys or my money or my experience makes me know better. He would say, yeah, we got to do it better. And that was like awesome to see and an awesome lesson to learn.
And as a director, how do you let the cast improvise on the show?
Well, in the early going, I think the guys were very willing to, they almost indulge, their background is in improv. They come from the multi-camera comedy world, mm-hmm. which is very structured, very manicured in its approach, you know? So to have this director who wanted the actors to improvise and play, and I would engage them in that way, I think they thought it was cute. You know what I mean? And they indulged me in the early going because I was excited and enthusiastic. And frankly, I had just come off of something. This Might Hurt was semi-improvised. And they liked the end result of that. And they hired me partially because of the way that looked and felt. So they I think, were willing to indulge my desire to have the actors improvise a bit.
And you also have a reputation of working very quickly. And I wonder if that comes from your improv background as well, and why that is important to work quickly in comedy.
It's very important. Yeah, I think. Number one, I just talk quickly. So it's my innate rhythm is fast. So maybe I'm keying off of that. That's one thing. The other is, I just think from a broader perspective, that you want to take advantage of actual this feeling of momentum. You want to make discoveries on set, and you want to put those discoveries on camera, and you want to take that positive feeling, that feeling of making that discovery, and let it give you momentum into the next thing, to make the next discovery. And if you're shooting too slowly or moving too slowly or getting too bogged down or too obsessed with one thing, you don't develop that momentum, that positive feeling. And, you know, it stops being as fun. And maybe that works for drama because you're putting heavy emotions on screen. But in comedy, at the end of the day, especially in television comedy, you're trying to capture actors having fun. And you can't do that if it takes too long.
It almost sounds like you look at a day of shooting as one big long form show.
Yeah, kind of.
Like, we got to keep this energy going. We got to keep this energy going. We're going to edit here. Okay, let's move on.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes. Deciding when you've had enough of a scene, when you've got it, when it's in the can is, I guess, part of it is right brain and part of it is left brain. Part of it is logical and saying, okay, in my head, I've ticked off. We've gotten this shot and we've nailed this joke and this joke. I think I've got this X, Y, and Z. But part of it is just a feel. It's just a feel on the set. Like, we've shot the scene enough. It's in there. Let's move on. And that's the same feeling when you're standing on the sidelines in an improv show deciding to edit. This scene, the energy of this is complete. Time to move on to the next thing.
And I bet you in a lot of ways it keeps your perfectionism in check, because you've got to make that decision like, you know what, maybe the scene is not going to be perfect, but if we go over it two or three times, I am going to ruin the energy for the rest of the day.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's what I'm always trying to weigh is like, yes, if we do this again, maybe we get that one line a little bit more perfect. Maybe we get a different version of this. But do we sacrifice something in the way that the next scene goes? Because everybody feels just a little bit weighed down. Everybody feels like, you know, there's that sense of like victory in a scene when you get that take where you're just like, oh, you know, everything worked there. You want to capitalize and you want to ride that feeling of victory into the next scene. If you do one more that's not quite as good, and then everybody's like, oh, okay. The air goes out of the balloon a little bit.
And how do you build an ensemble? You have an ensemble cast. You work with ensembles, you know, in your sitcoms. How do you do that? Because they're coming from a slightly different, not everyone has improv experience. Some people are getting paid more than others. Some are, you know, been in the business longer. Some haven't. I mean, you're dealing with all sorts of different things. How do you build group mind when you're on a set?
I mean, part of it's through energy. Just that creative energy. I think doing a pilot requires more options, more takes, more experimentation. In each of the shows I've done, Modern Family and Life in Pieces now, you know, we start off, we improvise a lot more in the pilot and in the early episodes. And then as the characters and the tone of the show get dialed in, there's less of that. I used to sort of dream about doing these semi-improvised shows for network TV. And I now think that maybe it's not possible, because I think that the grind of it, the sheer number of episodes that network TV demands of you, it weighs on the energy of the actors. And without a great script there to support you when you get tired and you don't quite have the energy to bring to your sort of peak level of inventiveness, I'm not sure you can do it well. So I kind of think that in my early attempts to do that semi-improvised style for network TV, I was misguided.
It's got to be a good script, and then you let them improvise around the good script.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In the especially in the early going, and I do think that builds ensemble, and I do think that you know, asking the actors to show a little bit more of themselves through improv lets them get to know each other as performers. Life in Pieces was a unique challenge because the stories are so separate on the pilot. They only work together, the entire extended ensemble worked together for one day. Everybody else worked together sort of in scene partners, you know? And so it was really up to me and up to the other writer producers to kind of help guide the tone of what we were doing so that when it was cut all together, it felt like one thing.
And what do you like about working with, you know, multiple storylines, not a traditional sitcom, and also, it's about families. Both Life in Pieces and Modern Family, you know, are very similar in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, look, I've thought about that some, and I do think the fact that I come from this close-knit family and have such a close relationship with my family has definitely affected my facility with that kind of material. On the other hand, I just think it's kind of luck. It's where I landed at that time, you know, doing that meeting in Steve and Chris's office and ending up in Modern Family. It's just kind of what I've become known for. And so I'm okay with that because it's sweet. But at the same time, when I say it's sweet, what I mean is it combines sort of like real, genuine, grounded, emotional stuff with hopefully, you know, some broader comedy that makes you laugh. So I think that combination is part of who I am as well.
We've got to wrap this up. A couple quick questions really quickly. Yeah. Why do you think Modern Family was so popular?
Well, you know, what I just said is part of it. I think at the time that Modern Family came on, there wasn't something, a family comedy certainly, that had that tone, that attempted to be grounded and attempted to sort of touch you at the same time as making you laugh. And there's also just geniuses behind it. I mean, Steve Levitan and Christopher Lloyd are geniuses. I mean, they're incredible. Steve is in some ways the showman and understood really the form of the show early on. And Chris is a storytelling genius. I've never seen somebody assemble the pieces of a story like Chris. It's unbelievable. And together, they have the ability to churn out quality in a way that is very rare in television. And so that leads to longevity. Being able to create great episode after great episode is really hard, and they're really great at it. So I think that's a big part of the show's success. And then also, you know, this incredible cast. You have to hit on every single character. You can't have a weak link. That's the end of you. If there's a weak link, it kind of all unravels. I think that's another part of it. And then the last part of it is it struck a chord, I think, at the time. Its diversity was unique. Showing, you know, a gay couple, a mixed race marriage. Those were new-ish things in family comedy, certainly. And that struck a chord.
Did you know Eric Stone Street from Chicago?
I did. In fact, Eric Stone Street was in This Might Hurt as the major guest star in the episode. And because I knew him all the way back to Chicago, he did This Might Hurt for me as a favor. And when we were casting Modern Family, when I came on board, Steve and Chris had already auditioned him. They were having trouble finding and casting the role of Cam. They had auditioned Eric and liked his audition, but didn't love it. And I watched it and I liked it, but I suggested we bring him back in for a callback because I knew him and I knew how funny he could be. And in between his first audition and his second audition, Eric had this lightning bolt moment where he realized that the character was his mother. And at this point, he's told this story a bunch of times, but that second time that he came in and I was in the room, it was magic.
And how's that feeling for you? Because you take a risk, you bring him in, you know how good he is, and then he hits a home run.
I mean, that was awesome. And that was a big step in the early going, I think, of me proving myself to Steve and Chris, because I put my neck out there and said, like, let's take another look at this guy.
Favorite moment of doing Modern Family? One that sticks out in your mind?
I mean, there's lots of them. You know, I came back and I directed an episode, season three. I did the whole first season. I left the second season to direct a movie, and then I came back.
The remake of
third
Arthur.
Season. Yeah. Yes. I came back in the third season, and I directed this episode that had a scene between Phil Dunphy and Haley, Ty Burrell and Sarah Hyland. And it was about her losing her virginity. And he found out that she lost her virginity, and he was losing his mind about it. And they did this scene in what was essentially a version of the American Doll store, the American Girls Doll, whatever they call it, that doll store that mm-hmm. kids are obsessed with.
Yes.
And it was like this scene where they were talking in code about his freak out and losing her as his little girl. And there's something about that scene that might be my favorite scene in the series that I've directed. It was hilarious and weird, but it could also make you cry, honestly. And made me cry when I saw Ty Burrell's performance. And like that was that sort of encapsulated why I love the show.
And how does that compare to winning an Emmy?
Well, you know, that was an awesome moment too. It wasn't a creative moment. I mean, obviously it feels great to be recognized, but like, again, if we're bringing it back to the theme of this conversation, I would put that second or third or way down there in comparison to like the exciting moments creating the thing.
You know, we got to wrap this up, but it's very clear to me that you are all about the work. You know, and for me, it's about the money, the fame, giving some Emmys. But you, it really is the work.
I love it. I'm obsessed with it, honestly. I still love it.
We always ask the last question, and thank you so much for going a little over. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Okay. I'm having a good time.
We always ask the same question to all our guests. What would you tell someone who's starting out in improv today?
For me, improv is an amazing tool to learn about yourself. Who you are comes out on stage in those moments. You can't help it. Your subconscious comes flying out of your mouth. So pay attention, because you can learn about yourself. So number one, use it to learn about yourself. But also, be aware that there's all kinds of other things that come out of the experience of being an improviser. There's the incredible camaraderie you form amongst the people that you're in groups with. And there's other things that you can learn if you're paying attention. I feel that I've learned story structure from improv, and from long form improv in particular. But I've learned all sorts of other things about the game and the scene, about repeatable comedic dynamics that I apply all the time, every day in my work.
Jason Weiner, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerds in the Can. Boom, boom, boom. We're just turning them out, baby. We're turning them out. I want to thank my guest, Jason Weiner, for being such a great guest today. Also, I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, big thanks to Mark Serletic, who edited out some of the noise in this episode. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, if you want to check me out, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, check out my Improv Nerd blog, and also my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives. That's at jimmycorain.com. Also, we're taking over social media. Go to Facebook and like our Improv Nerd page. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and our wonderful YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and see clips from our live shows. We're also part of a great podcast collective called feralaudio.com. Check out all the great podcasts. Todd Barry, Dan Harmon, Chelsea Peretti, Jimmy Corain. I love slipping my name in there. Listen to all the great podcasts on feralaudio.com. Want to thank all three of my sponsors today. Huge Summer Intensive in Minneapolis, the 8th Annual Improv Festival Oklahoma, and the 2006 Palm Beach Improv Festival. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban, and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans, and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air, and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype, and that he has come for his cocaine. as he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish.
Oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my